Thank you. I'm really happy to be publicly unveiling this work for the first time, because it's something that I've been thinking about really since I started working in quantum information. But a lot of the progress happened recently. And so this is joint work with Thomas Joachim O'Connor and also John Preskill. So the general class of ideas we're thinking about, so you can think about Hamiltonian complexity. So this is a subject that is about, you know, understanding how hard it is to find ground states of many body physical systems. And one way of characterizing this is to see that it's as hard as guessing the right input to a quantum circuit. And the idea behind Hamiltonian complexity is that computations can be locally verified. So the local Hamiltonian terms are like the constraints that see that you did the computation correctly. And so a major open question, at least in my mind, is whether the complexity of many-body ground states, which we've learned a lot about from this field of Hamiltonian complexity, can be extended to understand the complexity of systems at non-zero temperatures. And a closely related topic is adiabatic preparation of ground states. This is a universal model of quantum computation, at least in the ideal noiseless case. But a long-time open question is whether these kinds of constructions can be extended to cases with noise and maybe interactions with an open environment. So by constructing universal quantum computation in a finite temperature Gibbs state, my goal is to understand both the complexity of thermal physics and to make progress on this question of whether adiabatic computing can be made fault tolerant. Today, I'll be discussing a static construction. So there are a lot of challenges in understanding how to dynamically prepare that. But if you're familiar with the history of these ideas, the static states, ground states, were the first thing to be understood. And the preparation of these, efficient preparation of these, took a lot longer. So there's a lot of background to these ideas. I'm going to start by motivating it with ideas that come from the classical world. So classical ground state computing, classical self-correcting memories, and okay, maybe you've seen both of those things, but I've also thought about classical computing in thermal equilibrium. Solving this problem surely must be a prerequisite to understanding the quantum case. So also, you know, then we generalize it to the quantum case and think about quantum ground state complexity. And again, this is going to be related to universal adiabatic computation. Now, something that is maybe less familiar, but has been worked out by people in the last 5 years or so, are universal adiabatic computers and circuits in ground states that involve what are local clocks. So if you're familiar with the Feynman-Kitaev clock, one ingredient in what I'll discuss today is making this clock local. And my idea here is to combine these history states with topological quantum error correction. So I'll give a little background on that. And you know, finally, I'll kind of in this introductory section summarize what was figured out previously about suppressing errors in adiabatic computation. So then I'll start to describe my work. So the idea is that if we want to have circuit Hamiltonians that apply operations that are local over some code with macroscopic distance, then as much as possible, we should take advantage of the idea of transversal gates from quantum error correction. So this means that we need to have these local clocks. We'll kind of understand why when we translate it to the Hamiltonian language. It'll also turn out that to make all of this work, you can't have a universal set of transversal gates for any quantum error correcting code. And so to make all of this work, we're actually going to take the classical post-processing and include it as a coherent part of the history state in order to make the overall system time independent and thermally stable. So Another new ingredient that came out of taking the space-time view of quantum fault tolerance is the idea of dressing stabilizers, because each qubit has a local clock, and they sort of need to know what time it is locally. So that's something interesting. And also the analysis of these ideas. So hopefully by the time I describe the construction, it'll seem pretty plausible that it has to work. But of course, we have to analyze it. It's very challenging. So what we're focusing on is a special case where we can use symmetry to understand all of these excited states that enter into the Gibbs state. And then also, if you're familiar with the analysis of these Feynman-Kitaev history states, one applies kind of a global rotation to undo the computation. And I'll describe that in the introduction section. And it's pretty awesome how that works in this encoded history state picture as well. So hopefully I can convince you that philosophically the reason that this has to work is because it's really comes down to the four-dimensional view of a fault-tolerant quantum computing laboratory, including all of the wires you use to measure the quantum computer and the classical PC that you use to do post-processing. And then I'll summarize. But all of this stuff is going to be overhead, polynomial overhead, and it's kind of worth understanding that, you know, polynomial overhead, it's a theoretical construction. So I'm not saying you should go out and build this. We're just trying to understand whether this is possible at this stage, and then we can work on getting that overhead down. So classical grand state computing. So this connection between NP completeness and constraint satisfaction problems comes out of the idea of locally checking computations. So you can think of a Boolean circuit where you have gates with inputs and outputs, and enforcing the correct operation of this circuit, you know, amounts to Boolean formulas, X1 or X2. So you can equivalently map this this Boolean circuit, these inputs and outputs, and all of the time steps of the computation into a Boolean formula. And so imagine that if you can, imagine constraining all of the inputs and outputs of these gates and constraining the final output bit, but doing nothing about the input, right? Then your formula is asking whether there is some input that satisfies the circuit. And this is equivalent in power to a non-deterministic Turing machine. So this is the connection classically between constraint satisfaction and NP completeness. And of course, in physics, we can map these Boolean formulas to interacting Ising spins, zeros or ones. And this is why we know that finding ground states of spin glasses is an NP-complete problem. So classical self-correcting memories, probably familiar to many of you, ferromagnetic repetition codes. We can enforce them with ferromagnetic interactions between local spins. A good example is the 1D Ising model, where we can, so think of the 1D ferromagnetic Ising model. This is not a very good classical memory because thermal fluctuations can flip a droplet of spins. And once you have one of these connected droplets of flipped spins, it can grow with an energy cost that only scales with the zero dimensional boundary. So you don't get much energetic suppression of errors. But of course, the 2D Ising model, the energy cost of growing some droplet of ones in a sea of zeros scales with the boundary of the region. And this leads to a thermal suppression by a Boltzmann factor of these configurations. And this is related to why we have ferromagnetic order in the system below some critical temperature. And ferromagnetic order then means that the magnetization has to be very close to maximum or minimum, and this encodes a bit reliably in the repetition code. So, of course, this is how storage media work at room temperature, at least classically. So this is kind of built into a lot of materials. So now let's think about how we can put an entire classical computation into a Gibbs state. So we're going to encode each bit of the input and output constraints in our Boolean circuit into one of these 2D Ising models. So you have both the ferromagnetic icing interactions in each of these logical bits, and then between the physical bits in corresponding logical bits, you want to also include the interaction that enforces the correct operation of the gates. So the full Hamiltonian then has a part that enforces the operation of the circuit and also a part that enforces being in the code space of this repetition code. So maybe hopefully it's intuitive that if you're below the critical temperature and all of your gates are frustration free, right, then the Gibbs state of the system will have each of the logical bits exponentially close to plus or minus maximum magnetization, and therefore the repetition code will do its job, and the entire computation now is encoded in thermal equilibrium. So in this old paper, my first paper, we analyzed a similar construction, but it was kind of easier to analyze than this intuitive picture I've given. But the point is, you can do this. Maybe it's not something a lot of people cared about in the classical case, but again, that's a prerequisite for solving the problem quantumly. Okay, so now we have to go through the standard construction of quantum ground state computing. So encoding the time steps of a quantum circuit into distinct sets of qubits doesn't work because the quantum intermediate states of a quantum circuit are highly entangled, and local operators can't distinguish highly entangled states. So the idea that gets around this, of course, Kitaev solved it, and he had to repurpose an old idea from Feynman, which is to entangle the time steps of the computation with this additional clock register in this entangled superposition that we call a history state. Now, for analyzing these history states, well, the whole point of creating them is that they can be checked by a local Hamiltonian. And so, you know, here I've kind of written the local Hamiltonian terms. You can see that they have this form that, you know, you update the time register, you apply a gate. Of course, everything has to be Hermitian, backwards and forwards in time. And then you can also, you want to include an input projector, right, which assigns, say, higher energy to the all ones, so that you actually start in that zero state, and then this sort of H prop term enforces the propagation of your circuit. And then another detail that I won't describe too much in today's talk, which is to actually make this into a local Hamiltonian, the standard technique is to encode the time register in this unary representation so that you can actually act on just a few qubits at a time when you update this time register. So the analysis of these circuit Hamiltonians all happens related to this global unitary W that undoes the computation. So it's diagonal in the time register basis, and you just kind of apply the whole circuit up to that time. So what happens when you conjugate the Hamiltonian with this unitary transformation is that it undoes the computation, and all you're left with are these hopping terms with identity happening on the computational register. So these hopping terms just describe a particle diffusing on a line, and diffusing random walk like this on a line with t steps, right? The mixing time is like t squared, so is the spectral gap, is like the inverse of that. So that's how you can begin to understand the properties of this construction. So universal adiabatic computation, how does that work? Well, in general, with adiabatic computation, you want to prepare a specific ground state by slowly changing a Hamiltonian and remaining in the instantaneous ground state throughout that process. So here I've written a linear interpolation because that's what's used for universal adiabatic computation, but of course that's not strictly necessary. Okay, so there are various adiabatic theorems that make this, okay, that should be a inverse gap squared. Various adiabatic theorems that make this adiabatic principle more precise. Actually, it doesn't it's not really gap squared. You know, it might be gapped cube when you look at it specifically. But the point is that what it depends on inverse polynomially on the inverse minimum gap of the Hamiltonian throughout the adiabatic path, and also the overall energy norm of the Hamiltonian. Right, so the idea with universal adiabatic quantum computing is that you're gonna set H final to be that full Hamiltonian we saw on the previous slide, both H init plus H prop. And then, so that's just a tricky detail, but also the initial Hamiltonian for the evolution is just H init, well, H initial, whereas the final Hamiltonian is H initial plus H prop, right? So the idea is you want the final ground state to be that full history state. That encodes the quantum circuit. And of course, if you prepare that history state, then you can measure the time register and see it collapse and know that you're measuring the system towards the end of the computation. So of course, we don't just care about the spectral gap at the end of the adiabatic computation, but also at all the intermediate stages. The way this was proven, it uses a monotonicity argument. So you can see that the minimum spectral gap actually occurs at S equals 1. And we already discussed how that spectral gap scales inverse, like an inverse square of the overall runtime of the computation. So the point is the runtime of the adiabatic computation is polynomial in the number of qubits and the length of the circuit. And just to put it in a more familiar form, a lot of work went into using perturbative gadgets to show that universal adiabatic quantum computation can also be done with two local Hamiltonians. So this is one particular choice where you only need these ZZ and XX terms. Okay, so here's something that not as many people have seen, but has also been worked out by others. So instead of propagating every qubit according to this single global clock, we want to assign local clock registers to each of the individual qubits. So here, we'll call this a time configuration labeled by a bold vector. And so now your history state should be a sum over all valid time configurations with the state of the circuit at that time. So to kind of, right, so the reason, the existing reason for doing this was to help make these history state Hamiltonians more realistic when it came to physical implementations. And in fact, so this culminated in a construction where you have a two-dimensional square lattice with two-body interactions. So here you can think of this direction as time and this direction as space of a 1+1-dimensional quantum circuit. And instead of a hopping particle, you now have this diffusing string. And so when we talk about valid time configurations, the key point is that if two qubits are supposed to go through a gate together at time t, then you don't want to have one of them after time t and one of them before time t, right? That'd be invalid. So you include additional constraints in the Hamiltonian that exclude these invalid time configurations. And one thing to point out is this analysis in terms of a hopping particle was nice and simple. If you want to analyze a diffusing string through a lattice, that's a lot harder. But there actually was a nice way to do it for this diffusing string that you can find in these papers. Okay, so we talked about the generalization of classical ground state computing to the quantum case. Now let's talk about the generalization of classical self-correcting memories to the quantum case. So because quantum codes require the additional property of local indistinguishability of the code words, we're thinking of topological order rather than symmetry-breaking order. And maybe the most well-known example of this is the toric code. Now the 2D toric code is analogous to the one-dimensional Ising model. Thermal fluctuations create anions, abelian anions that are connected by strings. And once these pairs of anions are created, they can separate from each other and wrap around the torus to create string-like logical operators, and that makes a logical error. So the point is that because these strings can grow with a constant energy barrier, the lifetime of the 2D toric code is very short. But of course, this problem can be solved by considering the 4D toric code. So these, in this case, the logical operators are now two-dimensional membranes, and the energy cost of growing a logical operator scales like the one-dimensional boundary of the region. So it's also suppressed like a Boltzmann factor. So it's kind of like, right, and classically we had one dimension is no good, two dimensions is good, quantumly two dimensions is no good, and we seem to need 4D. In fact, it's still an open question whether finite temperature topological order, that is a self-correcting quantum memory, can exist in three dimensions. At least in the way that the toric code has such a large energetic suppression. There are some codes with polynomial energy barriers, but okay. So anyway, so error suppression in adiabatic computation, what was known before? Well, so if we think of this two local XXZZ type Hamiltonian, one thing you might propose to do is just replace these X's and Z's with logical X and Z from some error correcting code. So if you have a small code of constant size, so for example, a 4-qubit error detecting code, then Jordan, Fahey, and Shore showed that this can be used to suppress one local thermal noise. But this requires making the interactions in your adiabatic Hamiltonian now 4-local. And there's kind of a clear problem with trying to scale this, because if you want to use codes with a larger distance, the logical operators also become macroscopic. And this is incompatible with keeping the terms in the Hamiltonian local. So, okay, here's an idea. How about we take a fault-tolerant quantum circuit and just map it into a circuit Hamiltonian? So Seth Lloyd actually had a short paper where he wrote about this idea in a sentence and said maybe it could help with control errors. But there wasn't really an analysis behind that. And another thing that Seth pointed out is that this unitary equivalence to the hopping Hamiltonian actually means that all of the excited states of the hopping Hamiltonian also contain the valid computational history on the time register, right? Because once you have W dagger HW, this is what its excited states look like. So then when you get rid of those Ws, you put the computation back on the time register. So in fact, a lot of the excited states of this standard Feynman-Kishaev Hamiltonian already contain the history of the computation. And so why doesn't this already solve the problem? Why can't we just make a Gibbs state out of these? Well, it breaks down at a constant energy, because once you've violated the input terms, you're doing a correct computation on the wrong input. Okay, so now, switching gears, how are we going to solve this? So we want to combine these history states with topological quantum codes. So you take every logical qubit in the history state of your circuit, and you, of course, represent it as a bunch of physical qubits. So I'm using m for the number of physical qubits in each logical qubit, and imagine that scales polynomially in both the number of logical qubits and the total length of the computation. So each of the logical qubits will actually have many more physical qubits than the total length of the computation. And every physical qubit is going to have its own clock. So just as in the classical case, both the computation and the code stabilizers will be enforced by local Hamiltonian terms, but I've kind of written them vaguely here in a time-dependent form. Right, so this is the part that we saw before in this sort of space-time circuit to Hamiltonian construction with a diffusing string. And also, just to point out, the only reason it was a string was because they considered 1+1-dimensional quantum circuits. I mean, you could also imagine higher-dimensional membranes. The construction is just general and easiest to analyze in the case of a string. But this new ingredient here is that we're also going to turn on a code Hamiltonian at the same time to enforce the code space of these physical qubits. The propagation Hamiltonian ultimately needs to consist of local gates, and the code Hamiltonian needs to accommodate the propagation of the circuit without any frustration. And the reason for this, actually, if you just think of a hopping particle and then you add You add random potential terms at various sites. This frustrates the Hamiltonian and is actually known as Anderson localization. So instead of a nice diffusion through the time register, what you'll get is localization, and you no longer represent the circuit history the way that you want to. So this is why the code Hamiltonian will depend on the time configuration as well, in order to avoid frustration. And so the ground state of this will be the encoded circuit history, and it'll be a frustration-free ground state. So there are various ways you could think of building universal gate sets with, or universal sets of operations locally. The one that probably we focused on the most is transversal codes that have transversal gates, and also you can complete the gate set with teleportation. But I think the ideas I'm describing, well, yeah, they work much more generally. So, yeah, so gate teleportation, the idea behind this is that you'll do a logical measurement onto classical ancilla. You'll do classical post-processing, which really is a global processing of the information, and then you'll do conditional measurements, conditional logical operations on the outcome of your classical post-processing. And all of this will also need to be a part of the history state, and the classical bits will be encoded as well in repetition codes. So transversal unitaries in a local Hamiltonian, right? So transversality, just at the level of a gate, means that you want to apply a gate to a logical qubit, then you actually will apply it in tensor product to each of the physical qubits. But this is local in terms of gates, but is non-local as a Hamiltonian term. So we can't just attach this to the time register, right? Because it's acting on every qubit at once. So what we need to do is be able to act transversely on a few qubits at a time. And that's why they need to have local clocks. So the idea is that you'll have these propagation terms that, you know, you have some configuration of a particular logical, of two particular logical qubits, and you want to apply a gate at that time step, then you'll actually apply it to each pair of physical qubits, corresponding physical qubits in these two logical qubits at the same time to kind of propagate them together. So this H-prop term, you can just think of it like what we had before, you know, the individual clocks update by one increment, and then the gate is applied, and then the Hermitian conjugate of that. So the challenge is that if you want to advance all of the physical clocks in a logical qubit at the same time, well, that's not local. But if we advance them one at a time, then this conflicts with the terms in the code Hamiltonian, right? So one way to get around this in a normal picture of a self-correcting quantum memory is to briefly turn off the stabilizer terms while you imagine applying the gates. But we kind of can't do that here. So there's another solution that is a form of dressing the stabilizers. So to describe that, so the idea is you have some stabilizer code, and so imagine that you have an individual stabilizer term in this code, and it acts on, you know, many physical qubits. But it also kind of needs to know what the time configuration of those qubits is. And so the idea is that if you act on a staggered time configuration when not all of the local clocks are equal, then some of them have to be pushed, the ones that are ahead have to be pulled back, and the ones that are behind have to be pushed forward, right? And so in this way, we can avoid frustration even though we're still updating the qubits by individual local gates in this way. So here I've written kind of a single qubit gate, but it actually gets a little bit worse if you want to do a two qubit gate, because now these physical qubits have gone through a two qubit gate with physical qubits in another logical block. And to understand how to pull them forward and backward in time, you need to act on all of those qubits together. So this kind of blows up the terms compared to what you had in the stabilizer Hamiltonian, right? So if you had a, you know, K-local stabilizer Hamiltonian, then it's already looking like some multiple of that to talk to all of their time registers as well. But then when you have a two-qubit gate, you're kind of intertwining these dress stabilizers together. So all of this sounds like it's in danger of blowing up the number of local Hamiltonian terms, you know, beyond the rules of the game. But the idea is that all we really need to do is limit the staggered configurations to some kind of constant window. So remember, everything is time independent here. So you're including all of these local terms at once, right? They're all turned on at once. But the idea is that they act on these space-time configurations, individual clocks in the local qubits. But the key is that all of the terms you've written down know what time it is, so they know what the dressing is. So you figure out what the dressed operators to apply are, and then you can only include so many of these terms. So after a sort of constant window of staggering these time configurations, you can't include any more terms. And so then what happens is that the code prevents your time configuration from getting any more staggered than it already is. So, but the key is that we just need to update the qubits locally. And so actually just having the qubits in a given stabilizer be able to be one time step apart is sufficient to update them locally, right? We can't make the string or the membrane completely rigid. It still needs to move a little bit, but we can limit that by how many dress stabilizers we include. So universal sets of logical operations or universal sets of quantum operations that you can implement locally. So a nice example are the 6D color codes because they're self-correcting and they also admit several transversal gates. And you can complete the universal set by doing this gate teleportation to get a Hadamard gate. And what you need in this gate teleportation scheme is to be able to prepare logical X and Z, measure X and Z, and then do your classical post-processing and apply X and Z operations conditioned on the outcomes of those physical measurements. So, of course, when I say we're going to do this coherently, that means we're going to replace projective measurements on the physical qubits with coherent unitary operations, C naughts in this case, onto the classical ancillas. But the classical ancillas are logical classical ancillas. So the way to think about this is in a laboratory, each physical qubit should be measured by a classical wire. And the classical wire itself is a logical ancilla because, you know, the material properties mean that it has a repetition code. So this classical post-processing after a logical measurement of a single code block actually takes polynomial time if you want, you know, if you want a good guarantee in terms of fault tolerance. And during this entire time, the rest of the computation has to wait around, which looks extremely wasteful at the level of the number of additional terms you include in the Hamiltonian, but actually it's exactly what we do in the laboratory, right? Each clock cycle of a fault-tolerant quantum computer, everything is waiting around for the classical PC to be done with its job. So all of that is going to be put into the history state as well. So how can we possibly analyze such a sprawling construction? Well, it turns out that when you apply this unitary that undoes the circuit, it actually acts in just the right way on the dressing on the code Hamiltonian as well. So before, we had a hopping particle and no constraints at all on the computational register. So now we have kind of a diffusing membrane Hamiltonian that just describes these clocks diffusing, and then a static code Hamiltonian on the computational register in this unitarily mapped version of the Hamiltonian. So this is the version we can analyze, and then we can undo the unitary. So The idea is that, you know, we can use families of codes where the thermal stability of the standard code Hamiltonian. So this H code would just be like the standard color code Hamiltonian or toric code or whatever you like. And so it's kind of already been understood what its thermal states look like below the critical temperature. But analyzing this membrane propagation is extremely challenging in general. What's the spectral gap of the propagation of some higher dimensional membrane? So, but a nice trick you can use is instead of having the computation go from zero to time t, you go from zero to time t and then back again to time zero. You put everything on a circle and you make the computation homogeneous throughout, right? So you're always applying a 2-qubit gate to every pair of qubits at every time step. And the reason you do this is to achieve this overall circular symmetry. And what this will mean is that all the eigenstates of this membrane operator also have to have circular symmetry. So in other words, rather than this picture I showed of the states of the hopping particle looking like sines and cosines, instead they all just look flat over the time register, but with various phases that make them orthogonal to one another. So the circular symmetry is very helpful for getting any kind of grasp of the Gibbs state of this thing. We already kind of discussed, the transversal input term. So how do you enforce the input to the computation? So if you wanted to enforce being in the logical zero state of the toric code, you can't do this with local terms. But you can include local terms that act transversely on the ancillary code blocks. So you can prepare clean ancillas in the zero state, clean logical ancillas. And remember, these are also repetition codes, so now they look like ferromagnetic Ising models with one local fields if you want them to be zero. So you can think of having clean logical zero classical ancilla and some kind of, there's various options. You could have a maximally mixed state on the quantum register because what's gonna happen is that, so because of this property of the circular symmetry making all these time configurations equally likely, all the valid ones, the diagonal elements of the thermal density matrix in this time register basis have a uniform distribution over them. And then when you undo the undoing of the computation, you put these W's back, but now they're just kind of acting on the code block. And these W's already represented the action of a fault-tolerant protocol on one of these self-correcting memories. So the idea is you take the thermal state that's been analyzed before, you take the circuit protocol that's been analyzed before, and this is what you have is a mixture over your time configurations in your thermal density matrix. So one thing to point out is that the misspecification errors in local Hamiltonian terms, so this could be part of the error model you might want to deal with, but this can be resolved by the fact that this W, if it's really comes from a fault-tolerant protocol, should be close, say, in the operator norm to the ideal W. So this aspect is a way to maybe make to make Lloyd's idea precise about including fault-tolerant computation, fault-tolerant circuit Hamiltonians, but the thermal stability aspect is another aspect of this error model that is new here. So I kind of said that I just talked about a six-dimensional construction where we used passive error correction on the quantum computation itself. But what we consider much more realistic for near-term quantum computation, especially in three dimensions, is to do active error correction. So now imagine that you have a fault-tolerant quantum computer using active error correction, like surface code qubits connected to a classical PC. So now we're gonna do the error correction actively and correct stabilizers in time. So there's no energetic protection on the qubits in the quantum computation, but one thing to notice is that there is energetic protection in the classical wires and the materials in the classical PC. And so active error correction is possible because we dump entropy from a quantum computer into classical self-correcting memories. So a 4D self-correcting memory, you can obtain a 4D self-correcting memory from the history state of a three-dimensional active error correction fault-tolerant quantum computer. And so I think there's a connection between the search for planar fault-tolerant architectures and the search for self-correction in 3D. Now remember this: these WW dagger acting on the thermal state, right? You have clean classical ancilla, and so they take the entropy out of the thermal state and dump it into the classical ancilla. That's the mathematics of how this slide works. So the whole scheme, I thought of it through passive self-correction on the quantum qubits, but it should all work in the active case as well. It's just that you still need passive error correction somewhere, and it's on the classical part of the computation. So overall, what do we have? Well, it looks like we have universal quantum computation in a finite temperature Gibbs state of a K local Hamiltonian for some K less than 1,000. But again, this is polynomial overhead. And I think the major open questions at this stage, and the reason I focused on the static construction today, is that, you know, what's the right way to efficiently prepare these Gibbs states? Can we lower bound the spectral gap of the membrane Hamiltonian? Well, there's some papers related to this, but on the level of rigor, that seems kind of out of reach. There's some conjectures. The gap shouldn't be too small in any spatial dimension because it's a relatively free membrane diffusing. But is that even the right model? Because if we're talking about thermal stability, we need some open system dynamics as well. And also, it's a good idea to go beyond just this adiabatic spectral gap condition because we're really taking advantage of the excited states also encoding the valid configurations of the quantum circuit. So one way to possibly use the static construction is to ask whether it's QMA complete to decide the thermal energy at some temperature that's independent of the system size. So the reason I think about the thermal energy in this context, say rather than the free energy, both of which kind of generalize the known facts about the ground state energy being QMA complete, but it's hard to imagine being able to compute the free energy of this construction, whereas the thermal energy really just, if you include an input and an output constraint, should go up depending on the acceptance probability of the circuit. But the thing is, this breaks the circular symmetry. And now the states, the distribution over valid time configurations becomes non-uniform. And that's difficult to analyze. But we're working on that as well. So the propagation Hamiltonian by itself in the circular symmetry, that's solid. But when you start including input and output terms, we have some ideas, or it's you can understand from small cases what this does to the distribution over the time steps, but it's really hard to analyze. There are so many excited states, but I think this is a nice question. So the way that I think of the circuit propagation part of the Hamiltonian and the code part is that they're like a kinetic and a potential energy, and so maybe what's been missing before in our consideration of history states is this space-time view of the interactions between physical degrees of freedom. These dress stabilizers are really like the advanced and retarded potential in electromagnetism. Is time an illusion? So everything we know, everything that I know, is consistent with the idea that we live in a history state universe. And in fact, throughout this construction, every time we ran into a problem, you just go back to thinking four-dimensionally about a fault-tolerant quantum computer. So maybe this can even help, you know, since I'm here at Perimeter, maybe this can even help solve some deep questions in fundamental physics. And maybe it's time to revisit the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with the tools of quantum information. Thanks. Yes.
So Can you go back to this 4D picture of regular fault tolerance?
Yes.
So I didn't quite understand what you're doing here. So, I mean, so first of all, there's you know, fault tolerant constructions that don't use measurements, right? That do all the classical computation in quantum circuits. So how does that interact with what you're saying here? Is that, I mean, you said that you have to kind of take it into the classical things, and the classical things are self-correcting memories. But if there's no measurement, how does that come in?
So in this case, classical are the classical part of the computation. I mean, they are qubits, so they are coherent operations. So in a construction where all of the error correction is done coherently, how do you dump the entropy? How do you get clean qubits to begin with?
I see. So it's the preparation that you're using that for, not for the measurement per se.
No. I mean, there's no measurement in either any version of this construction. The idea is to do everything unitarily. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but you can't, of course, you can't do it unitarily. You need some, as you say, some non-unital channel, basically, to prepare low-temperature things.
So the idea in the active error correction is that you will have, so in the space-time view of active error correction, you have repetition code constraints on the classical logical bits, and this is what allows you to clean them up essentially and turn them all into zero states at the start of the computation. So in this kind of line here, you could imagine that you might have identity on the truly quantum part of the computation register and clean and things that are very close to logical zeros, right? So imagine this row here is identity on the computational qubits and the logical zero state or something very close to it on the classical ancilla, right? And then this W from your fault tolerant protocol will take the entropy out of that identity matrix or maximally mixed state on the quantum register and put it into the clean ancillas on the classical registers.
I mean, it's not, it doesn't have to be a code. And I mean, it's enough to have your qubits in contact with a very low temperature thermal bath that so they can relax down to the ground state with high probability.
So that's interesting. So this would be like instead of a repetition code, just having one local interactions. That.
I mean, it's yeah. I mean, so normally you would. Yeah. So normally, if you're trying to eliminate the measurements, you will take your classical bits into repetition code. But that's not the state preparation part. That's the measurement part. And there probably are other ways around that don't use a repetition code. Although it's the only one I've ever seen suggested.
I see.
But the the part that kind of has to interact with the outside world is getting the zero physical single qubit zero states to have high fidelity.
Could that use algorithmic cooling?
Well, yeah. So I mean, I have this paper with Michael Benoit and Avinash Tanghasidim. Actually, what we show is in a model where kind of you have some non-unital channel at every time step, and otherwise you can only do unitary things, then it can be any non-unital channel and then use algorithmic cooling to get that to get zeros, basically.
So
all you really need there is something non-unital, which means a low temperature bath. And in practice, it would have to be very low temperature because, you know, fault tolerant thresholds and whatnot. But
yeah, so that makes sense. And I think the fact that I'm thinking of the Gibbs state of the repetition code already creates this non-unital aspect.
Well, no, I mean, I think the fact that you're dealing with finite temperature is a non-unital thing.
Yes, exactly, right. There's an implicit environment to be discussing a Gibbs state. So, so maybe we can think about the four-dimensional view of the method of fault tolerance that you're describing, and that should be adaptable to these history states as well.
Yeah, I mean, the... Yeah, okay. I don't see that the self-correcting element of it shows up anywhere.
Uh-huh. No, I see what you're saying.
I mean, the repetition code is... it's a repetition code, but it could also be 1D repetition code. It doesn't have to be... The geometry is not that important there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, more specifically, you can do the same thing in one plus one dimensions. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, okay. again, you have to interact. Well, okay, no, I take it back. This, this thing with the algorithmic cooling, you might not be able to. I don't know. That was an open question, I think.
Okay.
But the rest of it, you can put you can certainly do active fault tolerance in one dimension, one spatial dimension, without any measurements. But you still need to be able to reset qubits. That's true.
Yeah, but yeah, okay. And so maybe that's an ingredient, because if you just have a one local bias on the spins to make them zero, this won't give you an exponential lifetime for a single spin at any constant energy scale and constant temperature, right? So maybe in the paper you're describing, there was implicitly the idea that you could renew them later on. They didn't all have to be around from the beginning.
No. So okay. So the paper that I was mentioning. So okay. So there's two separate things. So first of all, this old result about doing fault tolerance in two dimensions, one dimension, which basically is in this original Haranov and Benoit paper about the threshold.
Yeah.
And they include, you know, doing all the classical computation and as qubits, all that stuff. I mean, it's a circuit model, so there's this assumption that you can, the only non-unitary thing you have to do is put a qubit into a zero state.
Mm-hmm.
And so there you definitely don't have them from the beginning. Now there's this other issue of, suppose you don't have that all the things you control are unitary, then it's a question of what the noise channel does. You can take advantage of the noise if it's a non-unital thing in order to do this resetting procedure. So the
right.
easiest case, if it's just amplitude damping, you just put the qubit aside and wait, and eventually it'll go down to zero. But I think, but forget that part for the moment. I mean, it's the active version where you can reset qubits.
But what does that really mean, resetting qubits, right? I mean, that entropy has to go somewhere.
Sure.
We have to follow it. And maybe the problem is that to use the formalism of the history states, the evolution has to ultimately be unitary. You know, that is, one could try to include constraints that project onto certain measurement outcomes, but these create the frustration and the localization problem. That sounds interesting. Well, if there are no more questions,
yeah,
thanks everyone.